Hi there. You're dulled from the Bear game, I'm sure. This is Rick Kogan. The show is called After Hours, and this first hour is dedicated to what I believe should be on every Chicago lover's Christmas gift list. It is a book that bowled me over. And, you know, I can be hyperbolic, but this is the honest Rick Kogan. Lakefront Anonymous, Chicago's unknown art gallery by William Bill Swislow and Aaron Packer, is among the most remarkable books I have seen in as long as I can remember. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure. I actually thought you'd fall off the chair when I said that. It is a gathering of a number of photographs of and vast information about things. You may consider yourself a Chicagoan, but Aaron Packer at one point started to look down. I have always recommended to people to look up because they never see the buildings around them, Bill. Aaron Packer runs a gallery. Bill, take me back to, obviously, the first time that you and Aaron started to discuss the dozens, if not hundreds, of carvings that dot the lakeshore.
Well, so Aaron Packer became known as a gallerist, but earlier in his life, he had visions of being a photographer.
Yeah.
And he was taking photography classes at Evanston, and he was looking for a project to do, and he was interested in this photographer, Aaron Siskin, who would do these sort of flat images of things like funny lines in the road, like, mm-hmm. and they were sort of abstract. But photographs, and Aaron at the same time was often on the lakefront riding his bike up and down. And at some point he saw, you know, you see like the first of these carvings, if you ever bother to notice, and most people don't.
Most people, that is a striking thing about it. I've noticed over the years, but that's just because I'm old. I've noticed whenever I walk the lakefront, I try to keep my eyes open, and I've noticed not all of these carvings, but I've noticed them in some of the paintings that people do on the lakefront.
Yeah.
Did Aaron must have been, when he first started to see these things, he must have been slightly overwhelmed?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think he was just got really excited because he had this photographic interest, and these were perfect because they were flat, and sometimes they had like paint spilled on them, so these sort of random things. But he was also interested in folk art and vernacular art, so art by ordinary people, which when we get into it, this is what these carvings are, is made by ordinary non artists. So, and I think what happened is he would see one, and then he started seeing more and more and more, and then that was his project. And he actually had a show at the Cultural Center in 1991.
Remember.
Of his photos of these carvings. But he got busy with his art gallery, and, you know, he kind of forgot. He didn't forget about him, but he gave up the dream of being a photographer. But he did tell me about these carvings.
Yeah.
So I started noticing.
That was probably
them.
Literally. That was Bill and I have known each other a long time. We worked together at the Chicago Tribune until Bill got smart and got out of there. But there's no better person he could have told, because your interest in art and is passionate.
Yeah, we shared that. Aaron and I shared this interest in vernacular art by self-taught artists. And in fact, I frequented his gallery and bought work from Aaron of other kinds of work. So I got interested in it, although it took me years to get fully engaged.
Why?
You know, I was busy with other things.
Yeah. Having a daughter, he's got his beautiful daughter Emma in here. Yeah, yeah.
Raising my beautiful daughter, starting an internet business for the Tribune.
Sure.
For, you know, the cars.com business. So
whatever cars.com is, and I know it's incredibly successful. When Bill and I first met, he was at the Tribune as an internet expert. At the time when I was, I think, still using a dial phone, so we didn't have this kind of shared stuff, but he's gone on to do a lot of stuff. When did you get back? When did it come back to you, this whole?
I sort of casually started looking for these, and we moved to Edgewater in 1996, and there's a lot of these at Foster Avenue Beach.
Yeah.
And I started noticing them, but, you know, still, it was just casual. What really got me fully engaged and ultimately led to the book was in the early 2000s when the Army Corps of Engineers and the city started rebuilding sections of the lakefront.
Yeah.
And when they would do that, in most sections, they would tear out these old rocks, which we haven't fully explained yet, but
sure.
They would tear out the old limestone blocks and replaced them with concrete and steel. And these blocks are where the carvings live. And I realized that these things were starting to disappear. And Aaron had fortunately taken a lot of pictures in the late 80s, early 90s. So he's photographed many of these carvings that I never even saw that are gone now. And his photos are probably the only documentation that still exists. But at that point, when and of course, it's the human story. It's only when things start disappearing that you start really valuing them in many cases. So
Like the planet's climate. Yeah.
Yeah. And then at some point, you know, and then digital photography made it really easy to start documenting things. I'm not a professional photographer. So starting in the sort of late 2000s, I started doing it more systematically. And then when I really understood how many of these rocks were going to be destroyed, I decided, you know, I got to find out where these really all are. Because I knew about the ones at Foster Beach, and I had gone to Promontory Point.
Sure.
But it turns out they were everywhere, all the way down to Calumet Park Beach, which is at the Indiana state line.
And they started just, I'm going to read. The book is mostly photographs of these stunning pieces of art. But the writing in here, too, which is mostly Bill's. Aaron's got a couple of very interesting pieces near the back, but it's mostly Bill's. I'm going to read some of that. This all kind of started in the 20s, right?
Yeah, so you know, the history of, I mean, people should be aware, if they're not, that the Chicago lakefront is all artificial.
Yeah.
It was all landfill. It was all landfill. I mean, almost all of it. And so the lake has been trying to get it back ever since.
Yeah, no kidding.
And, you know, I did some research, and every few years you find in the newspapers the latest story about this section of the lakefront being destroyed by whatever storm it was, going back to like 1900.
Yeah.
So in the 20s, they came up with this idea that they could quarry these big limestone blocks from mostly from Indiana, and they created these step stones they called revetments, and they lined the lakefront with them, much of the lakefront with them, in order to protect the park, the shore. Mm. And I think the oldest ones I've been able to date are 1925, which were at Fullerton Avenue. They're gone now.
Yeah.
You know, the oldest carving we've been able to date is from 1930, which is in Hyde Park.
As Bill writes in here, the anonymous carvers who created this art did it to no particular effect other than leaving behind their mark, albeit with a little bit of meaning as well. They necessarily left it exposed for whoever might bother to pay attention and to the hazards of time and fortune. All of it is weathered and some entirely lost, whether to natural erosion or to human construction. We are going to spend this entire hour getting more detailed about that. And Bill also does a wonderful job of, for those of you who don't know why there is a lakefront and why the lakefront, except for a couple of corporate intrusions called McCormick Place and other things, remains, I think, the great joy of Chicago. We got to take a little commercial break, but Bill Swislow will be here for the rest of this hour talking about his amazing book with Aaron Packer called Lakefront Anonymous, Chicago's Unknown Art Gallery. My friend Bill Swislow, William Swislow, on the cover of the book, has written an astonishing book, along with Aaron Packer, Lakefront Anonymous, Chicago's Unknown Art Gallery. It catalogs in incredibly compelling fashion these sculptures and etchings and, you know, I'm no artist, but I don't know what else you'd call them, along the lakefront. He says in the book, and the book is beautifully written, it's mostly photographs by Aaron Packer of these astonishing pieces of art. The carvings constitute a kind of social history of Chicago at play. From the southern end of the city near 100th Street up 22 miles to Hollywood Avenue on the north, if you look down, you'll see thousands of spots where someone left their name for the future, or memorialized a summer day, or maybe declared their love inside the outline of a heart, as you might expect in this kind of socialization and leisure place. When you finally, Bill, dug into this deeply, you must have been kind of overwhelmed by the art.
I am, and there are certain spots where when I first went, it was mind-blowing. So, and some of them are very hidden away. So behind La Rabida Hospital,
mm-hmm, sure,
at 65th Street, there's this little cluster of rocks, and it's the densest group of carvings that I found. I mean, it's just like almost every rock has names carved in it. This, the one rock that I always talk about And again, this is just hidden away. I mean, it's not even a beach there. It's just behind the hospital there. There's one rock that has on it a peace symbol, a peace sign, butterflies, flowers, the word peace, and best of all, a barefoot. So it's the whole hippie summer of love that someone just, you know, behind La Rabida Hospital carved into this rock. But there's 100 other carvings in that this one little, like, tiny little area, half acre behind the hospital there.
What impresses me and in a way kind of moves me is the fact that the vast majority of these artists, and I'm calling them all artists because they have created something, it did not do it for notoriety. They did not do it because their mother or father said, hey, go put my name in the rocks there. They did it just as a means of self-expression.
Yeah, or because they were bored.
Yeah.
You know, I talked to a lifeguard who worked at Rainbow Beach in the 60s, where there's a lot of carvings, and he told me that the lifeguards had a hammer and chisel, and they would pass it around, and when they were not busy, and he said his... He was often assigned to the south end of Rainbow Beach, which, if you know Rainbow Beach, there's not much beach there. And he said his only job was to tell people to stay out of the water. So he said, you know, so all the guys
ultimate lifeguard
down
job.
There where there are a ton of carvings, you know, they had all this time. And so they just carved their names. And it's funny because they would carve like 1952-345. So every year they would add another number that they worked there. They would add another number to their name.
I know you went after, and you found some. There's a chapter in here called The Carvers. You make the great point that some of the names are so generic that you'd have to call every single Al Green in every single phone book. But that must have been like a little, like a detective tale for you, wasn't it? Was it fun?
It was. It was fun. And it let me play journalist, which I used to be
used
a professional journalist. So, and of course, Google makes it easy, although a lot of these people weren't easily Googleable even.
Sure.
But, you know, like one guy, the first one I found was someone who had been involved in some historic preservation group in Joliet. Mm. So I wrote his historic preservation group and said, could you forward this on? And they did. And he wrote me back and I interviewed him. He had a weird name, Bob Nachtrieb.
Yep, I got it. Yeah.
So an unusual name.
And what did he say?
So Bob said, oh, that was really, what I did was really amateurish. But Bob told me the story about he and his buddy Cliff Weaver, who actually became a prominent zoning attorney in Chicago, and they're both still alive. I've actually corresponded with Cliff as well since the book came out, but they were freshmen at the University of Chicago in 1964, and they, you know, being, it was the spring, and they were freshmen at the University of Chicago, so they had to get out.
Yeah.
So early one morning, like 4 a.m., they took hammers and chisels they borrowed from one of the fathers and walked out to Promontory Point, and they carved their names and their girlfriend's names in the rocks at the end of Promontory Point. And what's so great is that they're all still married today.
No
still
way.
Alive, still
no
married.
No way.
But Bob Toby, I don't think he ever took his now wife out there. And actually, Cliff told me the reason they did it at 4 in the morning is he claims that Bob was embarrassed about going out and doing this. So they wanted to sort of do it when there would be no one around.
Is it against the law to do this?
Well, I'm sure it is.
Yeah.
But in fact, Bob said that he and Cliff were stopped by a police officer when they were walking out to the point and with their hammers and chisels.
I say, what are you two doing?
Breaking in a car. But they explained it, and the cop said, oh, you crazy, you know, kind of crazy.
Yeah.
And I've talked, you know, that comes up a lot, the question of, was it illegal? Did the cops stop them? And the few carvers I've talked to have said, no, the cops didn't care. Or in fact, if anything, they thought it was kind of interesting that we were doing this. Now, I think it could be different today, except you almost never see police patrolling these rocks.
Exactly.
So any carvers out there, would-be carvers, I'd say go for it. And I found a few new carvings, even in there's not nearly as many being made now, but, you know, there are occasionally you'll see one that's, you know, been made in the last few years.
You also make the point here that these carving, that this granite rock that came from Indiana,
limestone,
was perfect for what people wanted to do. I mean,
right.
It's a perfect medium in a way,
right? Because in fact, someone sent me a 1911 paper by a geologist about Indiana limestone, which is where most of these rocks were apparently quarried, who starts out his little piece saying, this is soft enough to carve with a pocket knife, with a jackknife. So I think that's the idea, that limestone is a relatively soft rock, but even though it is weathering away, it takes a long time. It's not like sandstone, which will weather a lot faster. Granite, though, they wouldn't have been able to do it. Like, ordinary people could never have carved that. So limestone was perfect. And it's this fluke that Chicago had miles and miles of this limestone that was available and accessible to the public, which is really one of the most special things about Chicago. The greatest things is the lakefront and that history that we started talking about before.
Well, you also make the case that this kind of thing is not unique in the world, but it's certainly unique to the United States. You use just a couple examples.
I would say the idea of you have an urban coastline with thousands of modern carvings is unique in the world, as far as I can tell. Yeah. I mean, Sydney, Australia has a lot of Aboriginal carvings, but those are hundreds to thousands of years old.
Right.
But in the research I did, I couldn't find anywhere that had anything like what Chicago has as far as this many carvings that have been made in the last 100 years. I mean, when I get pretentious about it, I like to call them, modern urban petroglyphs is sort of the highfalutin name for these things. But it relates it to, you can go to places like Hawaii or New Mexico, and there's lots of old petroglyphs.
But nothing 20th century vintage. Yeah. I am beyond fascinated with Bill Swislow's book, William Swislow, the author. If you want to look, it's called Lakefront Anonymous. You people are very smart who listen to this show. Lakefront Anonymous, Chicago's unknown art gallery. I'm sure it's available online.
If you go to lakefrontanonymous.com, you will find a way to order it there, or you can go to some of our fine local, a few of our fine local bookstores.
Or you can read the Chicago Tribune next Sunday, because I'm writing about this, not because we're old friends or now I'm in love with his daughter Emma, but the fact that this is such a Chicago book, and these things are in peril. I don't want to, sound a sorry note, but they are in peril. They've ever been in peril. You got to get some news, and we will come back and further travel the lakefront. There are, between the 150, 60-some pages of Lakefront Anonymous, Chicago's unknown art gallery, all manner of things that will not only catch your eye, but will catch your imagination and catch your spirit in a way. It is the carvings that dot pepper. They don't dot, they pepper the lakefront. They have been gathered in a new book called Lakefront Anonymous, Chicago's Unknown Art Gallery, by William Bill Swislow and Aaron Packer, and it is one of the most remarkable books. It's published by interestingideas.com, which I think is your deal. And it's a book that everybody who thinks they know Chicago and everybody who loves Chicago should have. It's not only a wonderful, concise history of the lakefront, but it is also a kind of a history of something you've never seen. Bill, when you started doing this and you talked to people about it, I can't imagine many people would say, oh, yeah, I know about those things. Mostly it was like, huh, where are they?
Exactly. Yeah. I'll be out photographing on, the lakefront of these carvings. And sometimes people will say, well, what are you taking a picture of?
It's a rock.
Yeah. And I'll say, well, there are these carvings. And they'll look down and say, I come out here all the time and I've never noticed these. And I think it's because people are generally looking up. They're not looking down.
Or they're looking at their phones.
These days.
Yeah,
but I do. You run across people who've noticed them, but the vast majority of people, when you talk about this, are blank. They've not heard of it because in terms of formal recognition, almost none. There's been, when Aaron Packer had that show in 1991 at the Cultural Center of photos of these carvings, there was a little bit of coverage as an art exhibit.
Yeah.
But also,
I know the media and this stuff, but also like as a curiosity.
You would think, the one time when big media acknowledged these until now was in 2000, the Sun Times wrote a story about the mystery mermaid on the South Side.
Yeah.
And it was a great story about this carving of a mermaid on one of these rocks, and that no one knew where it came from. And they talked to the park district, and you know, they looked in the archives. And then the day after that story ran, or the same week, the daughter of one of the carvers went to the Sun-Times and said, I was the model for the mermaid. My father carved that. And the Sun-Times did a really great story about the carvers, the main one being, who's still alive and with us, a guy named Roman Villarreal, who's was a steel worker, self-taught stone carver, and he's been active ever since, making carvings, and he's a painter, and, you know, and very active in sort of the art community in the far south side.
The people who you did meet, the carvers who you did meet and talk to, they must be very, very proud for the recognition, or some, like, there's one, for instance, who you got in touch with who did not want his name used, right?
Right, right. I think they're more surprised than anything.
You're doing what? A book about what?
Exactly. I think some people are still sheepish, or they might have privacy concerns. You know, some people carved their birthdays into the rocks, and these days no one wants to share their birthdays for fear of identity theft. But, you know, most of the people I got in touch with, and there weren't that many, because really a lot of them are dead or gone,
sure,
unfortunately.
Sure, sure, sure.
We're just surprised that anyone noticed, and particularly that anyone noticed what they did. You know, so like Bob Nachtrieb is the great example of that. No one would notice that, you know, in 1964 he carved his name out on Promontory Point, and you wouldn't see it. It's and in fact, I was out there with the editor of the Hyde Park Herald a few weeks ago, and I had a heck of a time finding Bob's carving.
Yeah.
Because if you're not there in the right light,
sure,
it can be hard to see these things.
Oh, how interesting. This is one of the great... It's a mystery story, it's a detective tale, and it's a fabulous art tale. And this mermaid is beyond beautiful.
Yeah, the mermaid is...
The mermaid is beyond beautiful.
It's a great carving. One thing that's nice about it is... So it's a full... This is like a 6 feet tall rock with a full-size mermaid carved on top of it.
Right?
You can go see it. It's at the south end of Oakwood Beach on the south side around 43rd Street. So it's the mermaid, but around the mermaid on that same rock, there are these fish and sort of waves that are carved. And what's nice is the mermaid was carved in 1986 on the lake at 39th Street, moved later onto the park. But at one point, it was at a park that had a teen art program, and Roman Villarreal was affiliated with that program. So he and the teenagers actually added the fish and the waves to the base of the mermaid as part of the summer program in one of Chicago's parks. So the mermaid is really, it's a beautiful carving, probably the most accomplished, one of the most accomplished carvings on the lake.
I agree.
Because the guys who carved it, the two main carvers, were real stone carvers who knew what they were doing. Not to say that people who don't know what they're doing can't make incredible art, and they've done that too. There's sort of all kinds along the lake in this sort of virtual art gallery.
Well, I am, as just being a guy, totally taken with the Bathing Beauties chapter and the different iterations of Bathing Beauties. And each one of these things speaks to me of some kind of short story. You know what I mean, Bill? It's like,
totally.
Who did this, and what was her name, and what happened to them? Stuff you learned about the lakefront. You do a wonderful job of being very concise and very articulate about the lakefront itself. And obviously, you give credit to the great Lois Willie for her book, and Julia Bacharach for her book. You must have gotten tremendous joy at doing some of that research.
Oh, the research was so much fun.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I have a background in journalism. I never loved interviewing people, but interviewing these people was great. Doing the research, going into the archives, I spent a lot of time at the Chicago Library, which has the Park District's photo archive, which is a great resource.
Yeah, and there's some great archival photos.
And much of it is now online. When I was doing the research, it wasn't all online. Finding photos, looking for every photo I could of the lakefront under construction, for example. They have these beautiful drawings from when Promontory Point was being built.
Yeah.
The original, like, architect's drawings of those things. So there's more to it than just the art and the carvings. There's the whole story of the lakefront and...
Which is a remarkable story.
It is. And what I tell people is Chicago is the city that always has had the reputation of caring about nothing but commerce. cars.
Yes, and money.
And money and doing things the easy way. Yet it is one of the rare cities in the United States and probably the world where almost its entire waterfront has always been accessible to the public or has been for more than 100 years.
Blair came in the former architecture critic for the Tribune did a Pulitzer Prize winning series some years ago about the lakefront. But Lois Woolley's book, this book, Lakefront Anonymous, should be the gateway drug for you people to explore a part of Chicago that we absolutely take for granted. And I do think we take the lakefront for granted. When we come back after our last commercial break, we're going to end this show with Bill Swislow talking about how some of these pieces of art have vanished and how some may vanish in the future. And this is a very tenuous time for the rocks and the lakeshore, because as you said early on in this program, the lake would like to take back what we people have claimed. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Well, we have a few minutes left with Bill Swislow, the author, with Aaron Packer of Lakefront Anonymous, Chicago's unknown art gallery. Go online. You can go to lakefrontanonymous.com. You can go to interestingideas.com. That will have it too. You can go to a bookstore. Remember those bookstores? They are likely, I hope, to have it, but it should be under your tree or under whatever else you celebrate around the holidays. It's a magnificent
pole.
Hang it from your Festivus pole. What's Aaron think? He must be happy.
He's jazzed. And the fact that this kind of came back to life is, you know, pretty exciting for him. And
well, he credits you for bringing it back to life.
He does. He's been lavish with crediting me, probably more lavish than he should be. But
more lavish than I've been.
Well, that would be neck and neck.
That would be hard to top. Before we talk about the future of this artwork, we were talking before about Jim Jacobs, the co-author of the incredible, I don't even know, you can't even call Grease a hit play, the phenomenon that is Grease. I'm going to put you in touch with Jim, and the reason is because at Foster Avenue Beach, you found something, right?
I like to think I found something, but what I found in my research was, if you're familiar with the original Grease, it was originally set in Chicago, which they of course sanitized because
Taft High School,
when it went to Broadway and became a movie. But there was a song in the original play called Foster Avenue Beach, which I think, and I would ask Jim if I ever get to talk to him, is what evolved into the song Summer Nights, which is one of the two huge hits from the movie.
Big hit.
But there was when I looked at, someone had transcribed the lyrics from the Foster Avenue Beach song, and there's a line that says, he painted on the rocks a summer souvenir on Foster Beach. You know, if you walk by the water, you can see a big red heart with two names inside, and one is his and the other's mine. And that's what sort of a lot of this is all about. Now, there actually is a carved heart at Foster Beach that says Jim and Pat, but I don't know if it's our Jim. But there is a picture of Jim that he provided to the Tribune many years ago for an article from 1960 of him sitting, I'm pretty sure, underneath one of the rocks that's illustrated in the book, that has the carvings of about 40 names on it. But I will say that Jim looks incredible in that picture. He's shirtless, he's got a beer, he's got a cigarette, he looks like James Dean.
I will tell him that. I will tell him that. I'm going to put you guys together. It has been a tragedy that some of these artworks that once graced the lake shore have been destroyed. Army Corps of Engineers and other things that have come around to, you know, dull, to my mind, the lakefront. I used to love, especially as a kid and a young man, climbing the rocks. I mean, it was literally like, I don't know what it was like, the journey to the center of the earth, that old movie. There is danger still for the artwork that peppers the lakefront.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is these limestone blocks were put in place a lot of them in the 20s and 30s, more recently in the 40s and 50s, and those actually aren't under any imminent threat, the ones that are north of Montrose Harbor. But the ones south had taken a lot of pounding from the lake, and they were, you know, and some of them were in bad shape. You could see rocks falling into the lake.
Oh,
and,
sure.
And you still can, which is where the imminent threat comes from. So, you know, the Army Corps of Engineers, which basically cares about flooding and erosion and making sure roads are passable, you know, really wanted to do this project to shore up the shoreline with something that could withstand another 60 or 70 years of pounding. And they did. Unfortunately, their plan, which they executed basically from Hyde Park all the way to Montrose Harbor, was to rip out these old limestone quarried rocks and replace them with concrete and steel. And as Rick alluded to, a lot of people find it soulless, sterile. If you go to like between Diversey and Belmont, which used to have beautiful rocks with beautiful art on them, and used to be a really major mecca for the gay community, it's now just concrete and steel, which isn't terrible if you didn't know what was there before.
Right.
But if you knew what was there before. And so a few of the rocks there were actually saved, apparently through the good offices of Tom Tunney, the alderman.
Oh, good for him.
Who made them save a few of the rocks that had art and carvings and paintings on them. But the vast majority of the rocks that were in the zone of this project were just lost. They're just gone.
You know, the way I think of it, Bill, is, you know, Chicago has a lot of different faces and a lot of different personalities. And this one that you and Aaron are detailing is an incredibly, to my mind, important one. Yeah, maybe the artists aren't famous and they aren't even named, but it's an aspect of the city's personality because we are unique in having a lakefront going almost all the way to the side of the city.
And the fact that, I mean, to my mind, it's that these ordinary people created their own monument.
Yep.
You know, we talk about the monuments and the controversies about monuments, but this is this sort of spontaneous collective monument to the lake and to life on the lake in the summer, which is really one of the best things about Chicago. And it was done by thousands of different people, not by some committee that commissioned an artist to do it. And I think that's incredible. Unfortunately, you know, there are still carvings in Hyde Park that are in imminent risk.
Sure.
There's a project that's been funded with the new infrastructure bill at Morgan Shoal, which is between about 45th and 49th Street, which is in really bad shape. And the plan, as far as I know, as of now, is to add some landfill and to sort of rebuild the lakefront there, and it needs it. But my fear is that unless someone notices and really raises their hand, the hundreds of carvings that sit on the rocks that are still there are going to just be lost in the shuffle. And, you know, the same prospect is in store for Promontory Point, which has already had one major preservation battle fought. And the folks who fought the original battle are gearing up again to try to make sure when the city works on Promontory Point that they'll preserve the limestone rocks there.
You, Bill Swislow, and Aaron Packer have raised the flag in Lakefront Anonymous Chicago's Unknown Art Gallery. You people would be nuts not to buy this for a Christmas gift for someone you love, even if they don't live in Chicago anymore. And most of the people you buy this for will go, "Oh my God, I walked that place a million times and I never looked it down." It is a rare and amazing book to be cherished. Bill, it is unbelievably great to see you. It's a real thrill to meet your daughter, Emma. Onward.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Emma thanks you for the shout-outs.
My pleasure. I can see it on her face.